government to this new country and into this service? What is the impression of the service?
Well, I thought they were a very efficient lot,
mm-hmm.
and I thought I've got to do a lot to hold my own sort of thing. Pretty high standard. Perhaps right at the beginning, I thought more of them possibly than they deserved, but nevertheless, their efficiency, mm-hmm. it may have been efficiency for efficiency's sake, but it was very high.
Who did you consider the outstanding personalities in your time?
Well, I don't... the government agents varied a lot, but I don't know that there was anyone really outstanding.
Mm-hmm.
In sort of retrospect, I think Freeman was the most outstanding of the lot. Yeah, most outstanding, you could say. Sort of Englishman, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing.
What about Cumberland and Brain and Codrington?
Well, Brain was a remarkable fellow.
Mm-hmm.
Brain was a very fine man. Now, he was out for the masses of the people, mm-hmm. the poor, you see, and he used to produce remarkable schemes. I don't say that all of them were sound,
mm-hmm.
but nevertheless, what he was out to do was to help poor villager and that sort of thing, particularly in the country parts, and that was his objective, you see, and everything he proposed was to that end, and from that point of view, I think he's a very fine man. He wasn't altogether sound, some of his
Wildcat schemes with him?
Yes, to some extent, because he had a brother in India who was a great cooperative man, you see.
Mm-hmm.
But he's a bit cranky,
mm-hmm.
in a way. But nevertheless, you couldn't but admire his outlook and his objectives.
No, I know this post of controller of revenue, I know he had a control of land matters. But before Brain came, did you feel that there was anything which could be called a land policy? Was there a policy, I mean, or was it just dealing with problems as they arose?
No, I think there was a land policy insofar, well, the crux of it was the Land Settlement Department, you see, that department
mm-hmm.
was set up to settle land on the people. And I think that's an extraordinarily good thing. And of course they did settle, gave Crown grants very, very practically for nothing to thousands of people in the, particularly in the dry zone areas, and the poor places and that sort of thing. You could get land there for a song, and you did. But of course when you talk about up country, the tea land, the rubber estates, mm-hmm. coconut estates, well, they were all in private hands, you see. There was little crown land there.
Mm-hmm.
What land had belonged to the villagers, these big estates bought up, you see. Paid a good price, maybe, but nevertheless, rather deprived the
mm-hmm.
villager of his piece of land, you see.
Yes. No, I was wondering...
But, of course, latterly, I mean... even before I left, there wouldn't be any alienation of land, say, to tea estates or that sort of thing. It was practically closed.
Crown land.
No crown land. They wouldn't let them.
That was
but that didn't prevent the estates from getting hold of villagers' lands adjoining these estates.
Yes. Did you feel that there was a class of Ceylonese in particular who could be called land brokers? They specialized in buying up dubious claims and selling it again.
Oh, there's a good bit of that, you know. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. In the Low Country, there was a tremendous lot of that, you know.
Lawyers, or...?
Yes, lawyers.
Proctor and Lawyer.
What do they call themselves? The Low Country Products Association.
Proctor.
They own rubber estates. They were property people, you see. But there was a tremendous lot of that going on, you see. Buying up titles. Money lenders used to do it to a great extent, you see.
Do you know Victor Correa?
I did, yes.
Was he noted for this sort of thing?
Oh, yes, yes. Victor Collier, he was a bit of a scoundrel, I believe.
what about Mother Weller? Have you heard of him?
No, I have, but I'm very vague. Was he Ratnapora or somewhere?
Kutnagar, I should think.
Oh, yes. Connie Gall, as we used to call it. I didn't know much about him, as a matter of fact.
You see, I know that in the 1920s you got this criticism of the Land Settlement Department, and government land settlement, land policy was severely criticized by politicians.
Hmm.
And I'm sure some of the politicians were well-intentioned, but I was wondering how far speculators had a hand in this criticism.
Oh, there was a good bit in that, I think, without any doubt. Mm-hmm. They weren't doing it pro bono publico, a good many of them.
They had interest in...
Oh, yes, yes. But then again, you get that sort of thing in every country. I wouldn't say it to...
Were they being, in effect, does this mean that they were being rather hindered by the work of the land settlement officer?
Oh, yes, yes, of course, you see.
Mm-hmm. In what way?
Oh, yes. Because, well, the land settlement officer, he prevented the... Of course, the trouble was, in all this business, while you got land settlement and you gave crown grants to all these people, they could show a sort of prescriptive right to the land. They'd been there for years, you see. They had no title. They may have some senus or something, which wasn't genuine as often as not. But what the land settlement did was to give them real crown title to that land, whatever they held it for. But the trouble didn't end there. Once they got the crown, they could sell it.
Uh-huh.
And these land grabbers would still get hold of them and buy it, you see. And I know in various places where I've been, I've forgotten now whether we did it in Ceylon, but we used for that reason to give them long leases, 999 years, so that they couldn't dispose of it, you see.
Yes, well...
But then the objection they raised to that, if you gave them a long lease, they couldn't raise money on it.
Yes.
Do you see?
But precisely, I thought you didn't want them to raise money because they would get into debt.
No, well, well you didn't, but...
I mean,
in many cases, it's very difficult if you've got land and you can't raise money. Temporarily, that's where the cooperative credit societies came in, you see. That was our counter to that. But they weren't at all popular, these long leases.
Well, you know that Brain inaugurated very much a scheme which is very similar in Ceylon, just as you were leaving.
Yes.
Well, neither is that popular. But, you know, this leasehold system.
No. Oh, no. Well, it isn't popular, but the principal reason isn't popular is they can't alienate it and they can't raise money on it, you see. And as I say, the answer to that, in theory at least, was the Cooperative Credit Society, which could advance them money, you see.
Yes. so it was well known in the Secretariat then that some of these politicians had an eye on to the main chance in criticizing land policy.
Yes, I suppose it must have underneath. We
suspected there.
Yes, but I don't think that... I don't know how much it would affect land policy deeply, except, as I say, to prevent these chaps from operating as far as you could.
Okay, I can remember this land commission of 1927 with Sir Lancelot Elphinstone as chairman.
Elphinstone as chairman, yes. Yes, but I must confess I'm a little bit vague about the South Division. It went on for ages, didn't it?
No, I was wondering whether the changes this commission agreed to in effect helped the landowners and speculators and rather hinder their lessor.
Yes, well, maybe. Uh-huh.
You're not certain?
No, I wouldn't. No. I wouldn't be.
Coming back to land policy itself, I was wondering why they hadn't... In order to prevent this sort of alienation by the peasantry, why one couldn't have a law of non-alienation, as I think in the Gold Coast and perhaps Nigeria, non-alienation to...
Yes, well, you could, but it wouldn't be popular.
No.
They wouldn't like it. The people it was supposed to benefit, they wouldn't support it.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same old thing, you see, as long leases.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't alienate it, you can't raise money on it.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't sell it, you see. Well, it may be good land, you can make a great profit out of it. You see, in this country today, there are great farms going for about £100,000, and then a farmer will work up and get a farm, he'd buy it for £20,000 or £30,000. And in 10 years' time, it'll be worth about £100,000 or something.
There are two aspects of land policy. This selling the land to the capitalists,
yes,
and then the cash crop cultivators, and that's tea, rubber, coconut.
Mm.
And B, trying to help the peasantry along to preserve their title and land and to encourage rice cultivation.
Mm.
Where was the emphasis and the balance between these two? I mean, have any idea?
Well, when I was there, the damage was more or less done, because all these tea estates, rubber estates, coconut estates, they were all fully established.
Uh-huh.
You see, in the old days, in Ceylon, right away back before the coffee days, all that country, wonderful country, but there was few people living there. And there was no development whatsoever.
Uh-huh.
And provided you developed the land, you could buy it for a song,
uh-huh,
which is actually what occurred in the coffee days and uh-huh, then succeeding that, the tea, you see. But all that land, if it was worth it, was absolutely snapped up
uh-huh
by capitalists, people with money, who had money not only to buy it, it was cheap enough, but to develop it, you uh-huh see. But, as I say, by the time I got there, all this land, practically, was taken up, mm-hmm, and there it was.
Mm-hmm.
But, I don't know what the present policy is as regards land, because you can't confiscate it. And, of course, it brings in all this question of plantation. Industrialized, of course, land owning is not so important. People don't depend on it. People in England don't all want to be landowners.
If I could jump to the constitutional sphere, I presume you recall this 1924 constitution, the one just before Donoghue,
yes,
in which there was an unofficial majority.
That's it, yes. Yes.
I suppose you had just entered the Secretariat when it was brought in.
Yes, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, I remember that, of course. And then we had this wonderful finance committee. You see, that constitution, the powers it gave to the elected peoples was negative.
Uh-huh. But it had financial power.
What?
They had financial power.
Yes, but only a financial power of veto.
Oh, I see.
They could not propose expenditure. They could refuse supply. That is what we put, refuse supply. That is, the government would put up proposals for expenditure and taxation and that sort of thing, and they could turn it down. And if they turned it down, there it was. But that's why I say their powers were negative in that sense. They could only turn down, and they couldn't initiate. That was where... So it wasn't...
It tended to be obstructionist, therefore.
Well, I think they did. Oh, very much. It invited it, you see.
And they were...
Of course, the government, as far as their constructive, say the elected members' constructive proposals were concerned, if the government agreed with them and proposed expenditure, well, then the thing went through like anything, you see. But that was the main, when you talk about giving them power, you see, it was power in a negative sense. They could only refuse supply, but they couldn't initiate expenditure. They couldn't spend the money they wanted the way they wanted it. The power was still with the government, you see.
I'm surprised that they went ahead with, I'm surprised that they established such a constitution, because looking at it on paper, it looks bad. It looks as if it won't.
Yes, it does, but of course it was a step forward. It gave the electorate greater voice and greater choice in their representatives, you see. It gave them that, and it did give them control over expenditure of money, in a way. But as I say, it was very, very limited. But of course it was a step forward, there's no doubt about that. But all the same, the real power still lay with the government of the day, you say.
Would you say that the center... Oh, you wouldn't say then that the center of gravity shifted from the executive council to the finance committee?
Well...
In practice?
No, not wholly, as I say, it's only to a limited extent.
Could it be said that the finance committee could be so obstructionist that in practice again, the executive committee had to give, council had to give way to the finance committee?
Well, to some extent, yes. Oh, yes, that was true, you see. Because the executive, they decide on policy, and where policy means money, if the finance committee refused to vote that money, well then the policy, as far as that's concerned, couldn't be given to it, you see. We had a similar arrangement in Jamaica when I was there. It was known as the Power of the Nine. There were 14 elected members, and there were 14 official and nominated members, you see. And the Power of Nine was this, that any financial measure, if 9 of the 14 elected members voted against it, it was out. Didn't matter. The votes of the other side didn't count. Well, that was, again, a negative power, you see. But it didn't take them very far.
Did the politicians go very far in their personal, at this stage, in the 20s, did they go very far in their personal attacks on civil servants and heads of departments?
No, I don't think so. They did on certain individuals, perhaps. You know, one civil servant would get a reputation for... Even a magistrate would get a reputation for being sort of harsh and that sort of thing.
And they would bring this up in council?
Oh, yes, so they'd bring it up.
I thought the civil service didn't like this sort of political interference and political criticism.
No, I don't think they did. No, quite frankly, I don't think they did. Even if it were justified, they sort of wouldn't like it. It was, nevertheless, it had some effect. There's no doubt about that, I think.
What sort of governor was, how would you appraise the three governors of the 1920s, Manning, Clifford, and Stanley?
Well, Manning was, he was a soldier, of course, or had been, and he was one of the old school sort of thing. There was no question of very just governor, but no outlook as far as the form of the constitution. There was no question that he didn't worry his head about that, you see. Clifford was an amazing character.
Mm-hmm.
He was brilliant. He was a genius akin to madness, there's no doubt. He was quite brilliant. But he disliked proposed reforms of the Constitution, and this Constitution you referred to.
Mm-hmm.
He used to go around the country and say, "I have no power now." He used to tell the people, "It's no good you appealing to me. You've got to appeal to the legislature." That's the line he took. He was very interested in land. In fact, he wrote some most wonderful dispatches on the land system, and he did influence land policy a tremendous lot. He was brilliant in his way, but he was one of the old school, you know.
Very autocratic?
Oh, very, yes, yes. But never unjust, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Never unjust. And, but loved power.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. That was a great thing. He loved power. Now, Stanley was very democratic in his way.
Mm-hmm.
And it was during his time, of course, we had the appointment of the Donmore Commission on his recommendation, that sort of thing. He was... he was a great diplomat and very well disposed towards reform of the Constitution and so on.
He didn't seem to seem somewhat colourless. I mean,
well, he wasn't the personality of Clifford, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Clifford was a sort of outstanding personality, but Stanley certainly wasn't that.
I also get the impression that Stanley deliberately set out to cultivate the politicians and to...
Oh, yes.
He was to be more sympathetic and understanding.
Mm.
Was this flowing, shall I say, from his heart? Or, I mean, was it a policy he had deliberately conceived?
No. I think he was quite genuine.
Genuine.
A genuine wish to help forward this thing. There was nothing diehard about Stanley at all.
Mm-hmm. Now, I was wondering, in doing so, whether he rather alienated the civil servants, because he seems to have taken the politician's side on many matters.
Well, I wouldn't say he was tremendously popular with the civil servants,
mm-hmm.
but I don't think he... I think they understood, although they didn't like what he was doing. You can say that the civil servants, with few exceptions, were not keen on reform of the Constitution,
mm-hmm.
or not keen on, saying, working for the end of their jobs,
mm-hmm.
as they did later elsewhere, you see, with these other governments, where we've had self-government and that sort of thing. The civil servants were all for it and worked for it,
mm-hmm.
and in the result they all lost their jobs, of course. But in those old days they weren't so sympathetic.
The minds are not attuned to
that. No, they weren't. Their sort of political education, so to speak, was perhaps lacking.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that could be attributed to the failing of the governor, or even of the Secretary of State here, to say, lay down, that this has got to be done. We've got to work progressively towards self-government for these peoples, you see. And that should be a definite laid-down policy. Well, I don't think it ever was, myself.
Laid-down policy?
No, well, it wasn't carried to the extent of telling these civil servants, now look here, these changes have got to come.
Yes, I see.
I know they're distasteful to you, and naturally distasteful to you, quite understand. Here you've had all the power, and we've got to pass it on. The civil servants very often would say, well, it's nonsense, these people are not capable of doing this sort of thing. Well, then, at the top, we ought to say, well, it doesn't matter whether they're capable or not. Good government is no substitute for self-government, you see. And perhaps, looking backwards, we ought to have pressed forward this movement towards self-government, which was our declared policy. But instead of pressing forward, what gave it the sort of big fillip, of course, was the war and the changes. And then it was rather forced on us. We had no alternative. Then you got the American attitude towards colonialism. of course, the back of the American mind were the American colonies, this idea of colonies, you see. But, time?
5 to 1.
Right. Well,
can I bring you your drink?
We practically finished. Or would you like to go on a bit?
Just a bit,
yes, yes. Oh, well, we'll have a drink. Would you like a glass of sherry?
Yes, please.
You see, as I was saying, then circumstances rather forced the pace. But I don't know that, looking back, that we weren't rather slow in pressing forward with, unquestionably, what was our policy and has been. Give these people self-government.
Turning to this 24th constitution, the one before Donoghue, Clifford called it unworkable, but Stanley, writing after the Donoghue Commission had come out, called it a qualified success. And this is a...
Well, I think Stanley was right, myself.
It would appear that they're taking it in two different... looking at it from two different planes. I think Stanley was looking at the way it had been working and the fact that there had been some cooperation and that it had managed to function. But Clifford, I think, was looking ahead and saying that this sort of thing is with the people, with the executive and these politicians at loggerheads.
Yes.
And the possibility of crisis over everything. As really, in principle, impossible to continue.
Yes, that's true. That Clifford's view was, whatever merit it has, if it has any at all, it's no answer. And thank you, my dear. That's nice of you. But, of course, that 1924 Constitution was a stepping stone. There's no question about that. It was, just as we had reforms in India. But I quite agree it wasn't a very satisfactory one. And if Clifford condemned it out of hand, he said, well, this is no good. If this is all you're going to do, well, you might as well do nothing. Or alternatively, go the whole hog and give them self-government. He said, you've deprived me of any powers. He went stumping around the country. He said, I've got no powers now. You've got the legislature. Well, that wasn't true exactly. it certainly wasn't a solution. But I should say that as a stepping stone, it was a stepping stone in the right direction. And suppose you could say about it that it was a qualified success, as Stanley said, you see.
Mm-hmm. There seems to have been, one wonders whether it worked, because it simply had to work. Government couldn't take a stand on certain matters and refuse to budge, and because it is impossible to use the power of veto,
yes,
certification. And one wonders whether quite often the colonial secretary and the governor gave in to political pressure, though they didn't want to.
Yes, sort of a compromise. Yes, I think they, I think they probably felt bound to, as a matter of fact. You couldn't. There was nothing static about it. You couldn't. You either had to have a showdown or not. You see. Well, the governor might say, "Well, I'm not prepared for a showdown on this, at any rate." And,
I was wondering whether.